Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit...
Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
It's 3 p.m. on Thursday, and that means it's time to meet your maker. I'm your host, Rachel Wharton. My guest today is Jessica Prentice. She's a San Francisco Bay Area chef and cooking teacher who promotes traditional and sustainable food ways. She's the former education director for the Ferry Plaza Terminal Farmers Market in San Francisco and a founder of Three Stone Hearth, a community-supported commercial kitchen in the same place. But most interestingly to me, she coined the word locavore. Maybe 7 years ago, which officially became a word in 2009. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, I am sure you've had to tell this story many times, but I would love for you to tell us how it happened, the long version, starting with who you are and what you do and how you came to be interested in this stuff in the first place.
What is the question, like how the word locavore came to be, but the long version of that?
Exactly.
Okay. So I was, as you mentioned, I had been the education director at the Ferry Plaza Farmers Market, and I had left that job to work on my book, Full Moon Feast, which came out the year after the word locavore was coined. And I was at a writing residency up in Marin, where I was lucky enough to have 4 weeks to just write the book, which was key because when I got there I hadn't done too many chapters, and by the time I left I had drafted all of them, so that was great. And while I was there, there's a wonderful little bookstore in town, and I would walk into town from the beautiful place where I was writing almost every day just to have a little more human contact and just connect with other people. And the woman that worked at the bookstore was a woman that I knew from the Ferry Plaza Farmers Market. She had sold meat for one of my favorite ranchers who was located up there. And so we kind of connected just around local foods, and that rancher was really working on the idea of a local and sustainable food system and how to get people to value purchasing local meat rather than meat coming from far away. And so she was sort of steeped in those ideas. I was very steeped in those ideas. I had spent, my time as the education director trying to help people make the connection between all of the wonderful food at the farmers market and the dinner that they actually put on the table.
Which at the time was no one was talking or thinking that way, at least not on the
East
Coast.
It was starting then. When I first got involved in this work, I really felt like nobody was, or not nobody, but very few people were thinking and talking this way. But by this time, people were starting to talk about local and layering that in as another important thing to be looking for in addition to organic and other things. So, I mean, it's hard to now kind of go back in my mind to where people were at in terms of thinking, but there were definitely people who were talking about local.
Right.
And so Sage was one of them. I was another. It was in the zeitgeist. It was something that people were talking about. But it wasn't absolutely at the level that it's at now of something that people understand as a concept or
right.
consider a category or consider a criteria when they were purchasing for food. It
right.
was more those of us who were involved in the local foods movement. How do we get across this message that this is important and why? And so that was not necessarily central. I mean, my work on food has to do with our relationship to food. You know, the subtitle of my book is Food and the Hunger for Connection.
Right.
That's really my interest, is how can food be a vehicle to connect us with the planet, with other people, with our communities, with our culture, with our history, with our ancestors, with all the other beings in, the biosphere and the ethnosphere, kind of. That's what my interest is. So certainly local was a piece of that, because I had been for many years cultivating relationships with farmers, getting to know them, leading farm tours, having people understand how any issue that's important is affected by the choices that you make when you purchase food.
Right.
So I had been sort of steeped in that work, and Sage was too, and she was also reading Gary Paul Nabhan's book, Coming Home to Eat. She
right.
had just read that book, and where he takes, I think, a whole year and eats within a, I believe it's a, I can't remember what mile radius, but he chooses a mile radius and yeah. spends a year eating from within it. And she was very inspired by that. And one day when I was at the bookstore, she said, you know, I have this idea, what if we challenged people to eat, say, for 1 month within, say, a 100-mile radius?
Do you remember what month it was?
This was just her idea, was just to do it.
Uh-huh.
When she actually asked me that, you mean, it would have been April, yeah, April or May, because it was in the spring when I was up there. That she, you know, but it was just this idea, and she said, you know, tell me what you think. Do you think that's a good idea? And I said, well, that's interesting. Let me sleep on it. And then I came back the next day, and I was like, that is such a good idea.
How close had you been living to that ideal at that point already?
Well, like I said, I was very, you know. Spent a lot of most of my food dollars at farmers markets, and had a lot of relationships with farmers, and ate pretty locally. But you know, all of us had been talking too about what you could or you couldn't get locally. And so we and one of my big frustrations when I was at the farmers market was people coming up and, you know, in the middle of December saying, where are the blueberries, or coming up anytime and saying, where are the mangoes? And it's like, okay, where do I start? And so I had already sort of formed the idea for what would become the local foods wheel, you know, something that would show you foods are
right.
available locally and in what season. So that, because what I realized was that people were so disconnected from the production of food that they didn't even know what grew where.
Did you make that too? Is that also your creation?
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So I was already thinking about what kind of tool could I help to create that would teach people where their food comes from and when, so that, you know, they would understand why there aren't blueberries in December and why there aren't mangoes ever at the farmers market. So, you know, there was a lot of that kind of talk of, like, what is available and what's not, and what that's not available could be possibly grown. So, you know, how could we expand what's available locally? So those were all sort of ideas that have been coming up. And I certainly based my diet on what's local, and that's still what I do today. I mean, I don't draw a radius around myself, but her idea was to take 1 month and draw that radius to really see what would that look like if we didn't. And this was also at a time when it was right before we started to have really rising gas prices, and it was an interesting time because we hadn't yet gone through a period where we really got a sort of visceral experience of what it would be like to take cheap gas out of the equation.
Right. This is 2005.
We were all talking about the fact that, you know, our food system was unsustainable, and one of the pieces of that, you know, had to do with burning fossil fuels to ship foods and all of that. So,
right.
And you know, the global warming and all of that was not as present as it is in our minds today, but it still was definitely there. So anyway, these were just all ideas, and she threw that idea out, and I just thought, oh, that's just a perfect way to get people to focus on this issue, to just, like, draw a radius around and spend one period of time and see what does come from here and what doesn't, and to just get a much deeper understanding. And so I basically said, I'm in. I would love to help with that. And she said, well, I've got a couple other friends that I've been talking to about it, and so we all just, you know, got together, and after I left that residency, they came over to my house, and we had dinner and sort of thought it through how we wanted to structure it. She wrote up a press release, and one of the other women, Dee Dee Sampson, had worked at the Chronicle, so the press release got to the food department at the Chronicle, and Olivia Wu, who was a reporter there, decided to. It was perfect for her because she was looking for a story to feature for something that was happening in the city where they were focusing on sustainability. So there was this whole sort of citywide initiative to focus on sustainability, and she was looking for a related food story. And so it was a perfect thing to focus on, and she decided to follow me while I prepared one meal. So we sort of said, we're going to do this challenge, we're going to challenge other people, and then she came and followed me to the
farmer's market. Wait, do you remember what you made her?
Huh?
Do you remember what you cooked for her?
It would be in that original article, but it was a pork chop, and it was some kind of potato dish and I think snap peas. I mean, it was like meat, potatoes, and a vegetable, but all from the farmer's market. So she came and watched me shop for all those things and then came back to the house, and she brought a photographer with her, and I prepared the meal, and she ate it, and I took a photograph, and then they ended up putting it on. So then she was working on the article, and we were calling the challenge Food Shed for Thought.
Right.
That was Sage's concept, Food Shed for Thought. And so that's, you know, what the press release said and everything, and Olivia Wu didn't like that title. And I think she had even maybe done a series called Food Shed for Thought or Food for Thought, or she'd done something, and she felt like it was too tired and needed something new. And she said, and also, I can't write this article without saying who you are. And I'm like, well, we're just four women who are interested in this and are kind of part of the movement and think it's a cool idea.
And she was like,
yeah,
no.
Yeah, that's the problem. Yeah. I can't write an article like that. Like, you have to, you know, we weren't part of an organization. We weren't a company. We weren't, we didn't have any formal structure. We were just
four women who thought about this a lot.
Four women who thought about this a lot and had, you know, we're friends of Dee Dee. I mean, friends of Sage's, you know, each of us knew Sage. And so, anyway, she was like, no, you need to come up with a name for who you are. And I was like, women who eat locally, local eating women. You know, I mean, I was just like, what am I going to do? So,
I think I recall.
Let me do my best. When do you need it? And she's like, I really need it by five today.
Yeah. Yes.
And that's when I just sat down at the computer and started typing in everything, and I've always had a little bit of an obsession with words and etymologies, and so I just wrote every possible Greek and Latin root for to eat, and every possible Greek and Latin word for local or place or anything, and that's when I, you know, put together Locavore, and then I called Sage and, you know, told her. Well, I called her originally and said, we have to come up with a word, and all I got was a message. So I just left her a message, and then I called her back, and I'm like, you know, I've spent the past few hours working on it. This is the best I can do, Locavore. And she called back, and she's like, I love it. Sounds good. Go for it. So, and I think she called, I think we maybe checked in with the other women, too. I mean, it was really that loose, like, you know, is it okay with you if we use this word to describe us? And then I sent it to Olivia Wu, and she wrote back, love it. And then she wrote the article, and I had put up I had a website that was food-related, so I'd put up a page on my website about the challenge. And so then we put the word Locavore in there, and it was just crazy. The article came out, and, like, literally 10 days later, you could Google Locavore, and there would be just, like, a whole bunch of things.
Right.
Like, all of a sudden, just it was just like this. All these people were waiting for a word, you know, is what it seemed like, you know, to describe
what you did,
their passion and their interest and what they were doing, and people jumped on it right away, and then some people changed it to Locavore, and so then that became a little thing, kind of back and forth, is it Locavore or Locavore, and then it just sort of entered into, you know, not into the mainstream necessarily, but just anybody writing an article or needing to talk about these issues, it gave them sort of a frame. It gave them a meme that they were able to use.
Do you remember how Olivia used it? Did she call you the Locavores? Or do you remember how she did it?
I think she said, calling themselves the Locavores, four women, da 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 da.
As of 3 hours ago.
Huh?
As of 3 hours ago, four women
right,
calling
exactly.
themselves the Locavores.
Exactly. No, I mean, it was definitely created for her. The word was created for her to write her article.
But it worked.
But it ended up, I mean, it would have been a bit of a, I don't know. I don't know how the challenge would have gone without that kind of, you know, without having some concept or something that kind of had legs that could then run. So it did. It grew legs right away and had all, it got all this traction. And
do you remember why you decided not to use the L?
Yeah, I thought about it both ways, but to me, so local is, so the original word is locus, which means place, and it's where we get our word locomotive, or, I mean, local is one of, is an adjective that comes off that word, but it's not the root word, and
right.
So to me, Locavore is just, it sounds like a made-up word, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas Locavore sounds like it's that's how a word actually
was created by the ancient Greeks.
Yeah, right? You know, you take the two roots and you put them together, and vor is the same, you know, is also like devour. It's not just omnivore or herbivore, but it's also devour. It means to, I think, to swallow. And so locavore actually literally means one who swallows the place.
With that, we're going to take a short break and come back and talk about how the word lives today. This is Meet Your Maker on Heritage Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years, so it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Welcome back to Meet Your Maker. My guest today is Jessica Prentice, who founded the word locavore 7 long years ago. Hello, Jessica.
Hi.
So we were talking about how the word came to be, and I'm curious how, you know, it's almost like this child of yours. Like, how do you feel about the word now? Have you watched it grow and blossom? I guess it was the word of the year in 2007 from Oxford, and then it became an official word by the dictionary, Merriam-Webster, in 2009. They asked you to write a post on their website about when the word, I think, was officially recognized, which was actually a really lovely piece. But how do you feel about it today?
Well, you know, it's interesting because in the beginning, one of the feelings I had about I had mixed feelings about it from the very beginning because it was made up so fast and I put so little thought into it. And there's all these other things in my life that I've put a huge amount of thought into and put so much time and energy into, you know, like my book, like my local foods wheel, like the business Three Stone Hearth that I co-founded around that same time. And those are all like major, many years long labors of love with huge amounts of energy. And this was something that was like under pressure, like, oh, if you make me, you know. It literally took like an hour or 2 hours instead of years. And it's, you know, it's the thing that is, you know, most of interest about me or my work or people know me for in some circles. So that's always been a little bit of a mixed feeling. And in the beginning, actually, I wasn't even necessarily recognized for having coined the word because it was referred back to the four of us. And it was actually my partner who got really upset about that. My ex, but we were together for 15 years and she was there through all that. It just really frustrated her that here was this word that people were using that nobody knew that I had been the one to think it up.
And
she's like, but, you know, she'd see it in an article. She'd be like, but that's your word. That's your word. And like, and she wanted to, like, she was like, we should be getting 5 cents.
Yes,
use it, that kind of thing. And I'm like, no, you know, it's not, it was never something that I wanted to trademark or try to control in any way. But I did realize that I was, that it was something that I should take credit for because I had thought of it. And so I had my opportunity in an interview with the New York Times that happened before the word became word of the year. And the New York Times interviewed me, and I just said very explicitly that I coined the word. And so I don't know if they, you know, how they do their fact-checking or whatever, but they printed it in the New York Times, and it was that, and then she was very happy with that when she saw it printed in the New York Times. She's like, okay, like, that's the place that people will...
Right, the paper of record.
The paper of record, that's the place that people will refer to, and now it's on record that it was your word, and that was just important to her that I be recognized for that. And so then, from there, when it got voted Word of the Year, it was really nice to have Oxford University Press asked me to write that blog, because then I got to tell the story that also, I mean, part of why I didn't want to take credit for it was because, the whole Eat Local Challenge was not my idea. That was Sage's idea. And that was a great idea too. And that was an idea that had a huge amount of traction. And a lot of people did Eat Local Challenges, and that took off. The blogosphere got into that. And I didn't I didn't want to take credit for the whole thing. It was just this two-hour piece that I did. You know what I mean? So anyway, so it's always been a little bit fraught. And then somebody did try to trademark the word at one point. And
who? Do you remember
I don't
who?
Know if they did. And there's just somebody wanted to use it for business.
Oh.
And you know, so... But
what on, earth, what on earth would you sell with the word locavore in it? What were they selling? Do you remember?
You know, I don't know if they were... I don't remember, but... And I don't know if... I doubt somehow that... I think... I mean, that was what I was really happy about when Oxford University Press put it in the... You know, said it was a new word and put it in the dictionary, is I thought maybe then that would keep it in the commons.
Right.
Because I actually did look at, you know, how to protect it as you know, a word that was in the commons, and that seemed hard to do, too, and it all just got kind of overwhelming. You know, for a couple of years there were people that were like, you should make money off of that, and then there were other people that were like, you know, you should protect it so that nobody makes money off of it. And I was just like, you know, I have so many other things I'm working on. This is just really not my highest priority. This is just, you know, something I did in an afternoon and had all this traction, and that's because, you know, I feel the zeitgeist was there. People needed a way to sort of concentrate all that thinking and talking that they were doing. And Olivia Wu asked me to do it, and I did it. And then it just went back into the culture, and the culture needed it, and the culture used it. And so at that point, it wasn't in my control, and I didn't want to control it. And it's not a word I use that much, or, you know, but I do feel like, you know, when I'm writing, because, you know, I do write about local foods. Every once in a while, it's useful. And when I'm reading somebody else's writing about local foods and they use it every once in a while, I feel like it's used in the right way in a lot of senses. But to me, you know, after I did that 1 month, I've done a couple of challenges, but in terms of how I actually live my life, you know, I don't draw a radius around where I live. I look at where my food comes from. I really strive to eat as locally as possible and as seasonally as possible. And, you know, I have my little quirks. I get, you know, annoyed to see bell peppers on a salad in the middle of winter. You know, it's just one of those things. I'm like, why do you do that? It's so unnecessary. Just wait till peppers are in season. You know, I have my little judgmental moments about people's choices. But in general, for me, it's really the core is about relationships. And it's about relationships to farmers, it's about relationships to seasons, it's about relationships to the earth, it's about a relationship to my place and to the climate where I live, and it's, you know, that's it.
And well, actually, the term, I think, do you still, you use the, what you call that is wise food ways, right?
Well,
what
wise food ways was a business that I had that sort of before Three Stone Hearth, but to me, what, you know, Wise Food Ways is a general concept about having, you know, a wiser relationship to food, and eating locally is a piece of that. My interest in traditional diets and traditional food processing is another piece of that. So, you know, I kind of feel like my whole sort of food philosophy is really best laid out in my book, Full Moon Feast, where
right.
I kind of try to weave together all these different aspects, and local is really just one of them, but it's, you know, it can be very profound. There's just it's not a superficial idea. It is actually a deep idea that can penetrate into lots of other concepts and relationships with food that are very important. So it's not that I think that it's superficial. It's just that the word just kind of scratches
the surface,
or says very little about the whole thing, and it's only one piece in my mind of what I would consider a wise food way.
Right. So yeah, it kind of captures only this one rule, but none of the, like you said, like the connections that also come about from eating that way or that way in form.
Right. But what's sort of magical about it is that if you do that, if you
right.
say, if you take a month and you say, I'm only going to eat locally, it forces all this other stuff to the surface that you start to think about that you can kind of avoid in your daily life. I mean, it shifts where you shop, it shifts who you buy from, it shifts what you buy. And it actually puts you into relationship,
right?
Because you have to ask, you know, you have to go to a farmer's market, and you have to ask a farmer, where did it come from? And you have to learn, you know, you have to look at a map, and you have to, you know, start to understand why certain things grow in certain regions or not. And it can be the beginning of a pretty profound journey. But to me, it's really only, it's a starting point.
Right. I actually was interested in something you said in the, when you wrote for the, I think, Merriam-Webster, how you didn't feel like this could have happened, and the age of the internet enabled this term and even the concept to take off, which is kind of interesting because it's like the polar opposite, like the internet, which is all online, as opposed to eating this way, which is all right there, meeting people face to face.
Yeah, it's true. It's kind of a funny contradiction.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, the internet is a tool that I use, but I'm careful about, I mean, partly because I have a small child, I'm pretty careful about the relationship I have with technology. And, you know, like I don't have a cell phone, I don't have a smartphone. I'm not, you know, I have a laptop and I use it, but I actually try not to check email on my days off. Like I really try to limit my relationship with that whole abstract technological universe. And what I find is by doing that, it forces me back into, you know, the garden or the kitchen or into a place where I'm relating with my hands or my senses or something a little bit more direct.
I was actually, now that we're almost out of time, I wanted to ask you about the other business that you found. It seems like you've actually founded like seven different, you've been part of like seven different things that are now part of like the way people think about food in a new way. And this Three Stone Hearth?
Three Stone Hearth, yes, which I co-founded it's a worker-owned cooperative, and five of us co-founded it. And we call it a community-supported kitchen. And so it's what we're looking at, so we've been in business 7 years, so it's a functioning business. Actually, we've been in business 6 years. We had a year of planning before. And the idea is food processing and preparation on a community scale. So larger than a home scale, but smaller than a factory scale, how can we turn these local ingredients into meals for busy urban people, which is, you know, I live in the Bay Area. So we make soups and stews, we make casseroles, we make cereals, desserts, dressings, all kinds of things, most of which we put in returnable mason jars. People pay a deposit on the jar when they purchase the item, then they bring the jars back, and then we reuse them. So we're sort of minimizing packaging and waste.
And you're sourcing from local farms, obviously.
We purchase from local farms, so not exclusively. We use imported ingredients. We use spices. We use coconut milk. You know, what we can't access locally, we still use. But it's almost entirely, I mean, all of our produce is organic. Our grains and beans are organic. We really strive to source locally those things that we have a hard time sourcing locally, of which there are many, actually. There's many ingredients that are hard to
mangoes,
get on that scale.
Mango.
Huh?
That mango we were talking about earlier.
Well, yeah, we don't work with mangoes. I mean, that's sort of where we draw the line. We make a mole a couple times a year that uses plantains, and so we get some Mexican plantains. But for the most part, we don't use much imported produce. We use a lot of ginger, and most of our ginger out here is coming from Hawaii. So, which is far, but not as far as it would be for you. So, I mean, it's not, we don't pretend that we eat within a certain mile radius, but we do source our meats locally. We source our produce as locally and seasonally as we can. We just started using bell peppers. They're coming up from Santa Barbara now. It's, you know, it's not extremely local, but then the peppers are going to get more and more local. And as they get more local, then we'll be sourcing them more locally. We haven't used any eggplant since last fall, you know, that kind of thing. And we'll start, you know, you'll see a lot of eggplant on our menus for the next, you know, probably starting in the next couple of weeks when the eggplants start to come in, and until they're gone, and then we won't use them again until they're back. In the spring, we use greens and asparagus and green garlic, and so I mean, our menus are very seasonal, but they're not strictly locavore.
How many customers are you serving?
Oh, I wish I had the answer to that. We have in our database, we have about 6,000.
Wow.
We have on a weekly basis, we can do up to about 600 orders. Probably regular customers, we have somewhere around 1,000 would be just a really off the top of my head guess. But not everybody orders every week, so they have flexibility about what they order, how much they order, and when they order. And so we'll have some people that are really, really regular that order every week, except if they're on vacation. And then we have other people that'll order a couple times a month. And And some people who actually don't place pre-orders, but we try to make extra and have a walk-in store. And we have a lot of people that are very regular, but they don't. They just like to come and see what we have.
But you're like a CSA, but like the middleman between the, you're almost like they're getting their share and preparing it for them.
Yeah, I mean, the menu changes every week, so they it's not like they decide they want, you know, split pea soup. They can just order split pea soup. Like, we put split pea soup on the menu once or twice a year. You know, they get what we make. Right. And then we have some things that we make regularly. Because we're so steeped in the traditional diets work, we do a lot of bone broth. So every week we have a chicken broth and a beef broth. Sometimes we do a pork trotter broth. So we make broths. We do kombuchas, a whole range of kombuchas. We do fermented vegetables. We've got sauerkraut, kimchi, and those change seasonally as well. We can get cabbage pretty much year-round, but then the other ingredients will change. It's hugely interesting endeavor, a worker-owned cooperative. So that's been fascinating, and we've also got a bunch of employees now, and so that's been interesting. So, yeah.
Well, with that, we are out of time. I'm glad I got to squeeze that in at the very last minute. Thank you so much for joining us on Meet Your Maker.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yes. Please listen to Meet Your Maker every Thursday at 3 p.m.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our programs archived on our website or by searching iTunes for Heritage Radio Network. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website. Thanks for listening.